principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future, with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. William Luchtenberg is professor of history at Columbia University, and he's an Andrew W. Mellon Senior Fellow at the National Humanities Center, where he's completing the final volume of the Oxford History of the United States on America since World War II. Soundings now presents a unique opportunity for you to listen to a distinguished historian of society, politics, and the American presidency in the 20th century tell American history. At the National Humanities Center, Dr. Luchtenberg recently spoke about Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. What follows is an excerpt from Dr. Luchtenberg's discussion.
On April 12, 1945, Vice President Harry Truman was presiding in the Senate over a long, dull debate on a water treaty. When the debate ended, shortly before sunset, he made his way to the office of Sam Rayburn to join his friends for their usual afternoon round of bourbon and branch water. No sooner had the drink been poured than the Vice President was told to call the White House. The President's press secretary wanted him to come down right away, quickly and quietly. Truman put down the phone, raced through an underground tunnel in the Capitol, ordered a car, and unescorted, rode down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. Upon entering the executive mansion, he took an elevator to the second floor, walked down a corridor and into a study. There, Mrs. Roosevelt came up to him, put her arm on his shoulder, and said softly, "Harry, the president is dead." Franklin D. Roosevelt had died that afternoon in Warm Springs, Georgia. After a moment of shock, Truman recovered himself to ask Mrs. Roosevelt, "Is there anything I can do for you?" She replied, "Is there anything we can do for you? For you're the one in trouble now." That was an odd remark to make to someone who had just ascended to the highest office in the land. But Truman grasped immediately that he was indeed in trouble. For so totally had Roosevelt embodied everyone's notion of who the president was, that it seemed incomprehensible that anyone else could be president of the United States. One journalist wrote of Truman, "He walked as completely as did the smallest laborer who had been a Roosevelt man in the long shadow of the dead president." Many Americans could not remember when there had been anyone in the White House but Roosevelt, and they'd assumed, without thinking about it, that he'd be there forever. In the 1944 campaign, according to one story, a man said to a loyal Democrat who had just become father of a baby boy, "Maybe he'll grow up to be president." "Why," the man replied, "what's the matter with Roosevelt?" Yet, if it would have been difficult to accept anyone as Roosevelt's replacement, it was particularly difficult to imagine Harry S. Truman as his successor. When he first arrived in the Senate in 1935, Truman had been so much regarded as the minion of the Kansas City boss, Tom Pendergast, that he was referred to as the senator from Pendergastia. He supported most New Deal measures, but he was altogether inconspicuous. In the years when FDR was winning the admiration of millions for his eloquence, Truman, one account noted, was classed among the senatorial mutes. A newsreel crew dispatched to record one of his speeches was so exasperated by the number of retakes required that as they left, Truman heard the sound man say in disgust, "He ain't no Roosevelt." Even his friends acknowledged this. When Senator Schwellenbach went to Missouri in 1940 to help Truman in his bid for re-election, he told a campaign rally that there's been no better friend to President Roosevelt in the United States than Harry Truman. But he added, "I need not tell you that Harry Truman is not an orator. He can demonstrate that for himself." During the war, Truman had made more of a reputation. But even when Roosevelt chose him to be his running mate in 1944, Truman was known as the Second Missouri Compromise. Many of the New Deal luminaries who had been close to Roosevelt found the turn of events all but intolerable. David Lilienthal, the head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, wrote in his journal his response to the news of Roosevelt's death. "Complete unbelief, that was first. Then a sick, hopeless feeling. Then consternation at the thought of that throttle bottom, Truman. The country and the world doesn't deserve to be left this way, with Truman at the head of the country at such a time." 5 months later, on hearing Truman wisecracking in the doorway of his office at the White House, Lilienthal noted, "This remark epitomizes the humor of the Middle West, its barber shops and filling stations where men pass the time of day. But can you imagine a Groton president saying that?" FDR's humor had a different kind of expression. Also, FDR laughed. Truman grins broadly, and he does laugh, but it's so fleeting that it's hardly a laugh at all, more the sound effect of a grin. Some of this discontent stemmed simply from the fact that those who had admired Roosevelt could not summon up the same respect for a man who lacked the Groton imprimatur and was a Shriner, Moose, Elk, and lapsed haberdasher. One writer later remembered how a small town in East Texas responded, "Somehow, we just couldn't accept the haberdasher in the king's chair." When looked to Truman and saw not a president of Rooseveltian stature, but a man as ordinary as Mr. Bradbury, who ran the menswear store in Marshall, or Sam Hall, the Harrison County judge, imaginations would stretch, but not so far as to put either of these men in the White House. So why Truman? Often Truman did not receive even the minimal respect due to a man who held the same office that Roosevelt had adorned. On his first morning in office, he phoned RFC Administrator Jesse Jones to report that the president had appointed a St. Louis man to be federal loan administrator. "Did he make the appointment before he died?" Jones asked. "No," Truman replied, "he made it just now." As Truman himself later noted, everyone, including myself, still continued to think of Roosevelt as the president. Truman himself found it difficult to assume his role as Roosevelt's successor. When he woke up on the morning after Roosevelt's death, it took him some minutes to remember that he was President of the United States. That day, he went up to Capitol Hill for lunch and started to walk onto the Senate floor. "You can't go out there, Harry," an aide told him. "You're president now." He had to curb his inclinations to stride about town because he discovered that when he crossed Pennsylvania Avenue, the lights turned red in every direction. And he created mammoth traffic jams. 5 months after he took office, he was still writing Eleanor Roosevelt, "I never think of anyone as the president but Mr. Roosevelt." Truman grasped that if he were to win acceptance as Roosevelt's successor, it was crucial that he gain the confidence of those who had been close to the late president. He took particular pains to cultivate Mrs. Roosevelt because he recognized that she was the keeper of the flame. He began his presidency, the Alsops noted, by regularly phoning his predecessor's widow to find out what he would have done about this or that great problem. The president, they write, consulted Mrs. Roosevelt as he might have consulted a medium. Three days after he moved into the White House, Truman wrote her an 8-page letter in longhand. She responded by telling him not to waste his time communicating with her, but to get on good terms with Churchill. If you talk to him about books and let him quote to you from his marvelous memory everything on earth from Barbara Fritchie to the nonsense rhymes and Greek tragedy, you'll find him easier to deal with on political subjects, she counseled. Undeterred by this rebuff, Truman continued to woo Mrs. Roosevelt, whom he called First Lady, as though she was still the president's wife. If Truman had difficulty relating to Mrs. Roosevelt, he had a far tougher time getting along with those members of the Roosevelt circle who were coming to regard themselves as a government in exile. The Roosevelt followers sensed that however liberal some of Truman's policies might be, Truman was not one of them. At times, Truman committed blunders that appeared to indicate unfamiliarity with matters that were the very bone and marrow of the New Deal. At one press conference, he referred repeatedly to the Tennessee Valley Authority as the TWA. Disconcerted by Truman's performance, more and more of the New Dealers fled the administration. Before long, only two cabinet officers of the FDR era remained, Harold Ickes and Henry Wallace. It became of the greatest importance for Truman to hold on to both of them. But before the 1946 elections, each was gone. Ickes in a wrangle over domestic policy, Wallace in a dispute over foreign affairs. Ickes announced, "I can no longer retain my self-respect and stay in the cabinet of President Truman." More serious was the departure of Henry Wallace. It gave weight to the argument that Truman was a cold warrior who had departed from Roosevelt's policy toward the Soviet Union. Though Truman himself thought that his actions were consistent with FDR's attitudes, especially in his final days. Much of the dissatisfaction of the Roosevelt liberals concentrated on how he handled the transition from a wartime to a peacetime economy. When Truman threatened to draft striking railway workers, FDR's Secretary of the Treasury called the proposal an open and final rejection of the Roosevelt inheritance. In this instance, the criticism was well-founded, but often liberals showed too little recognition of how the political situation had changed since the days of the New Deal. Truman inherited all of the consequences of the pressure group state that had grown up under Roosevelt, and he had to operate it in a less auspicious time. As Barton Bernstein has observed, whereas the politics of depression generally allowed the Roosevelt administration, by bestowing benefits, to court interest groups and contribute to an economic upturn, the politics of inflation required a responsible government like Truman's to curb wages, prices, and profits, and to deny the growing expectations of rival groups. As the 1946 campaign got underway, it became clear that this situation was dissipating the political capital built up by the Democratic Party in the age of Roosevelt. And the cry grew louder that Truman was jeopardizing the future of liberalism by failing to be another FDR.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. William Luchtenberg is an Andrew W. Mellon Senior Fellow at the National Humanities Center, where he's completing the final volume of the Oxford History of the United States on America since World War II. Soundings is pleased now to present a unique opportunity for you to listen to a distinguished historian of American society and politics in the 20th century discuss the presidencies of Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. Here is Dr. Luchtenberg.
By the final stage of the 1946 campaign, Truman's stock had fallen so low that the Democratic national chairman told him to stay out of sight. And the party turned to recordings of Roosevelt's voice to bring out the FDR Democratic faithful. The chairman placed reliance on a series of 9-minute radio commercials. In one of them, a discussion of the meat shortage, a voice announced, "Here's what President Roosevelt had to say about it." Although the shortage had developed after Roosevelt was in his grave. The radio audience then heard Roosevelt discoursing on the leading problem of the Truman presidency. The Republican national chairman denounced this ploy as one of the cheapest and most grisly stratagems in the history of American politics. It was bad enough for Truman to be humiliated by having to take second place to a dead man. But on top of that, he was also blamed for the outcome of the elections. For when the votes were counted, it was found that the Republicans had control of Congress for the first time in 16 years. And incidentally, one of only two times in the past half century. The 1946 elections appeared to lead to one overwhelming conclusion, that having been badly defeated in its first test in 16 years without Roosevelt, the Democratic Party could not survive the loss of FDR. It was seriously suggested that Truman resign from office in midterm, like a British prime minister who had lost a vote of confidence, an idea that a number of people in the Roosevelt circle, including Harold Ickes, rushed to endorse. The notion originated with Senator Fulbright. Henceforth, Truman always referred to him as Senator Halfbright. In the next 2 years, as the Democrats with Truman in the White House appeared to face their first defeat in a national election since 1928, liberals looked back to the Roosevelt era with intense longing, and the worship of FDR took on some of the characteristics of a religious cult. Early in 1947, Fiorello LaGuardia said of Roosevelt, "How we miss him. Hardly a domestic problem or an international situation today, but what we say, oh, if FDR were only here." As Truman entered the 1948 campaign, Roosevelt continued to cast a long shadow. A sizable element within the Democratic Party sought to deny Truman the nomination on the grounds that he'd been disloyal to the Roosevelt tradition. Leading the Dump Truman movement were two of the Roosevelt sons, Franklin Jr., about to become a New York City congressman, and his brother Jimmy, who chaired the California delegation. Truman managed to survive this challenge, but that did not get him very far. He still faced what appeared to be impossible odds in the ensuing presidential race, and for more than one reason. It was not merely that many supposed that without Franklin Roosevelt at the head of the ticket, the Democrats could not outduel the Republicans. For in addition, the Democrats were fragmented. When idolaters of Franklin Roosevelt split off to create a new group, the Progressive Party, with Henry Wallace as their presidential candidate. This meant that the 1948 race would pit FDR's choice for vice president in 1944 against his selection in 1940. Many of the progressives, like European courtiers seeking to win the crown for an exiled prince in an earlier day, viewed Wallace as a legitimate heir to the Roosevelt succession and Truman as a usurper. Throughout the campaign, Wallace made the most of his association with FDR, who was hailed as the leader of the true faith. The story has an ironical twist. When Wallace took over the new republic in order to further his presidential ambitions, a member of the staff, Theodore White, made an astonishing discovery that Wallace literally loathed Franklin Roosevelt. For he had been the man who had made it possible for Truman to be in the seat of power that he thought rightfully belonged to him. In such a struggle, Truman badly needed the help of Eleanor Roosevelt. If she laid on her hands, it would be difficult for Wallace to claim that he was the apostle. Only in the final week of the campaign did Mrs. Roosevelt consent to speak on Truman's behalf. After the 1948 election, Truman, it seemed, would become president in his own right. Until then, he had been essentially a caretaker chief executive, who was, as he notes in his autobiography, merely, quote, serving out the term of Roosevelt. Yet even after his remarkable triumph in 1948, this was not the main theme, because writers continued to seize every opportunity to contrast him to Roosevelt and to insist that achievements that appeared to be Truman's were actually FDR's. No more in his second term than in his first could he walk out from under Roosevelt's shadow. Nor did Truman's anticipation that in his second term he would have independent recognition prove out. In 1949, Truman sought to establish his own identity by offering a program under a different rubric, the Fair Deal. But critics regarded it as little more than a warmed-over New Deal. One observer characterized Truman's tenure as Roosevelt's fifth term. As the criticism of Truman for not being Roosevelt persisted, began to alter the way that Truman thought about the FDR legacy. No matter what his critics said, Truman had always conceived himself as carrying on the Roosevelt tradition. But increasingly, he began to have second thoughts. In 1948, he'd been embittered by the role of the Roosevelt sons and of New Deal liberals in the Dump Truman movement. When the attacks on Truman for failing to measure up to Roosevelt continued into his new term, Truman took a more questioning look at the Roosevelt heritage, in one respect in particular. Nearly 3 years before his term was scheduled to expire, Truman decided not to run for re-election because he disapproved of his predecessor's example in breaking the two-term tradition. In a memorandum which he wrote for posterity in April 1950, Truman stated, "There's a lure in power. It can get into a man's blood, just as gambling and lust for money have been known to do. This is a republic, the greatest in the history of the world. I want this country to continue as a republic. Cincinnatus and Washington appointed the way. When Rome forgot Cincinnatus, its downfall began. When we forget the examples of such men as Washington, Jefferson, and Andrew Jackson, all of whom could have had continuation in office, then will we start down the road to dictatorship and ruin. I know I could be elected again and continue to break the precedent as it was broken by FDR. It should not be done." Truman's memoranda represented an effort to make certain that history understood him. And he cared a great deal about what history thought, for it was very much a vivid presence to him. One day in the 1950s, Truman came to Columbia to speak, and I had breakfast with him at the apartment of the political scientist Richard Neustadt. who had served on the White House staff. Truman devoured his ham and eggs and grits, sat down at the piano and picked out a tune, and then began to talk. He spoke in particular with considerable wrath about that man Douglas. I knew he did not always agree with Paul Douglas, the senator from Illinois, but I was surprised that he felt so venomous toward him. Then I slowly recognized that he was talking not about Paul Douglas at all. He was talking about Stephen Douglas, who was as alive to him as though the controversies of the 1850s, a century before, were contemporary. To such a man, it could not help but seem manifestly unfair that he was being perceived not as president in his own right, but only as FDR's stand-in. But Truman had good reason for thinking that there were other ways that history might judge him than merely as FDR's successor. Truman, after all, operated in very different circumstances from Roosevelt, not in a Great Depression, but in an age of economic growth, not in a struggle clearly defined against the Axis, but in a diffuse Cold War, not in a time where problems were overwhelmingly economic, but in a period when new issues like civil rights were surfacing. He should have been measured not by whether he was another Roosevelt, but by what success he achieved in coping with these very different problems, many of which defied easy solution. To a degree, he was so measured, but he never managed to walk out from under the giant shadow cast by FDR. A contemporary journalist summed up Truman's difficulty. His deepest misfortune was to replace a Roosevelt rather than a Harding, and to face each day the exacting challenge of comparison with his predecessor. Years later, Truman made a one-sentence comment that encapsulated his experience. Heroes know when to die. He was commenting on the greatness of Abraham Lincoln, but in a way that left his interviewer with a question. Was he making an analogy between Lincoln's death and that of Franklin Roosevelt? It became clear this was exactly what he was doing when Truman began to talk about Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, a man with whom he clearly identified. It took about 80 years for the truth about Andrew Johnson to come out, but it finally did, he said, and now people know what kind of president he was. Johnson had gotten into trouble, Truman went on, for one reason. He tried to carry out his predecessor's policy. Yet for all the undeserved abuse for adhering to the program of his predecessor, Johnson had proven himself to be a man of courage. The interviewer pressed on with another question. What would have happened if Lincoln had lived? A question that embraced a different but similar inquiry. What would have happened if Roosevelt had lived? Truman's response provided the answer to both questions, the explicit one and the implicit one. If Lincoln had lived, he would have had the same experience, Truman said. But like I said, heroes know when to die.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, inviting you to listen for the center's radio program, Soundings. This week's Soundings provides you with a unique opportunity to hear a distinguished American historian, Professor William Luchtenberg, tell a fascinating and humorous series of stories about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his influence on Harry Truman. Listen this week for Soundings.